part of what weighed on me so much was I knew that what I was doing was affecting me, but it didn't look like it was affecting anybody else. And so I started questioning in my mind, am I screwed up? Is there something wrong with me that it's affecting me and nobody else looks like it? Or is everybody else putting on the same brave face that I am?
That's Randall Snyder, and we're going to get to his story in just a couple of minutes today on Learn From People Who Lived It. First up, a note, or a word rather, from our January partner.
Hi there, it's Matthew Blades, and I want to tell you about my friends at Herbie Design, because we've been using them for more than 10 years for our hockey programs, but Herbie Design does team apparel faster and less expensive than most. They do embroidery, laser etching, custom awards, and really anything else you need to make your brand amazing. And I've used them to make all of my Learn From People Who Lived It thank you gifts and to create custom sweatshirts for our team moms and dads. But like I said, they're capable of so much more, and they can get it done faster and for less money than the others. Visit Herbie Design online at herbiedesign.com, and remember, they work with charter schools, dance schools, hockey programs, small businesses, large law firms, volleyball clubs, booster clubs. They can certainly work with you. When you get on the phone with Jim, let him know Matthew Blades from Learn From People Who Lived It sent you. You'll find him online at herbiedesign.com. That's herbiedesign.com.
Here's a question for you. Are you a transitional character in your lineage? It's one of my favorite things to ask people these days as a motivational speaker, and I would love an opportunity to come into your business, your nonprofit, your corporation, your church, your schools, and if you've got a group of people that could really benefit from the value of a self-care strategy so they show up better for you, let's do this thing. Rates depend on the size of your group, and we can connect at learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com. My 75-minute workshop is engaging. It's interactive. It's real. It's authentic. And most importantly, as I said a moment ago, your folks will leave with a self-care strategy that will have them showing up as the best versions of themselves for you. Learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com. Click on the speaking tab.
Find Learn From People Who Lived It wherever you get podcasts. Search it using all one word, Learn From People Who Lived It.
Welcome to another episode of Learn From People Who Lived It.
Randall, 45.
Randall, what story are you here to share today?
I'm here to share about my time working internet crimes against children and the way that that impacted me, the emotional toll that that took, eventually leading to a PTSD diagnosis, and kind of how that looked working through that both on the job and after my retirement, and hope to be able to provide some hope for the next person who's dealing with the same kinds of traumas to know that there's a way out, there's a way through.
Who do you hope hears this?
My first hope would be anybody in law enforcement that is dealing with these types of crimes, because there's a lot of us out there and it's a tough job to do, but really anybody who has dealt with any sort of trauma, whether it be a traumatic incident or a recurrent trauma, that needs to know that they're not alone. It's okay to not be okay, and that there are lots of resources out there to help people be able to move through that and still be able to live a good life.
I love it. I'm excited to talk with Randall Snyder today. He's a 20 plus year law enforcement. He had that 20 plus year career, and 10 of it spent to child crimes, including internet crimes against children. I know you were also an instructor at ASU for several years. And so first up, Randall, welcome to our podcast, Learn From People Who Lived It. How are you this morning?
Thank you, Matthew. I appreciate you having me on. And I'm, other than it's a little chilly in Arizona for this time of year, I'm doing great.
Yeah, good for you, man. You said a couple of things that got my attention there, because you and I share a similar goal, which is to help people feel less alone. And I can only imagine, man, that when you're doing internet crimes, child investigations, your lens of the world we live in has got to look a little different than most people. Is that fairly accurate?
It looks a lot different. I my wife didn't like me going into public because my conversations weren't always politically correct. They weren't always appropriate. But that was the world that I was living in. And unfortunately, not only did it kind of taint the way that I saw things and interacted with things, but unfortunately, it kind of made me think that everybody out there is a suspect, everybody out there is a bad guy. And it really colored the way that I looked at at everybody for a number of years.
So when you're doing that kind of a job, and we had a mutual friend of ours, Tony Rodarte, on the phone, you know, and he talked a lot about there's nothing anybody could say that would shock him. There's nothing anybody could show him that would shock him. Is that kind of true for you too? Have you seen the absolute worst of the worst?
I like to think so. Every once in a while, we come across something new that kind of blows us away. But for the most part, working 10 years of going after people who wanted to abuse children, exploit children, I feel like I've been there, done that, and seen pretty much the worst that humanity can present without, you know, too many opportunities for there to be anything new out there.
Conversely, have you seen the best in humanity when people come together to try to fix something?
Absolutely. You know, there are 61 Internet Crimes Against Children task forces around the country, and I've had the opportunity to work with a number of those. My cases took me to 8 different countries and 33 states around the U.S., and wow. I've got to say there are amazing people out there doing amazing work. Not even just in law enforcement, in the world in general, there are a lot of people out there really advocating for children, doing a lot of good work to try and protect the next generation. And to see the amount of dedication that's out there and the love that's out there for children, not even their own children, everybody's children, gives me some faith that humanity can be restored if we really want to.
I have this is an interesting, and I'm not trying my best not to give away too much, but there, about the time I met you and we came into contact with each other, I had somebody in my life that I knew who's a father, and his daughter was approached online. And this guy was basically, you know, trying to get her to send nude pictures to him. And he said, you know, I'm going to kill your family if you tell anybody about this. You're shaking your head like you've seen that dance before. And I remember the worst part about it was she felt like she couldn't talk to her own family about what was happening in those moments. And so where I want to start is with this idea that most parents have, which is it'll never happen to me. It'll never be my kid that goes through this whole thing. What do you say to parents who have that kind of attitude?
If your child is online in any way, shape, or form, whether it's through social media, whether it's going on to YouTube, whether it's playing video games like Roblox or Xbox or anything like that, they're going to be contacted. The most recent statistics that I've seen, last year, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children received over 29 million reports of children being exploited online. And that's just the ones that are coming to them. That doesn't include the ones that we're finding proactively. It's not including the ones that are being called directly into police departments and sheriff's offices around the country. That's just the ones that the tech industry is recognizing on their own and reporting. The average age of a child coming across some sort of exploitive image or some sort of sexualized image online is about 11. And on average, they're saying that about 1 in 3 children will be approached at some point. And those are just the ones that we know of. Those are just the ones that are getting reported. There are a lot more kids out there that are getting approached. They're not disclosing anything. Nobody's ever becoming aware of it. And so realistically, the numbers are probably a lot more grim than what we know of.
So you've got a book out. It's called Cyber Creeps. And in there, I'm sure you discussed this. But what do you say to moms and dads who, like, they don't even know where to start? Like, is it as simple as going to my son and saying, hey, man, are you being contacted by anybody you don't know?
Absolutely. It's just starting that conversation. And it's an uncomfortable conversation. Don't get me wrong. It's hard enough talking about the birds and the bees without adding on electronics. But I think that if you start those simple conversations, even just starting with, hey, you know, I see that you're on Snapchat, you're on Instagram, you're on whatever you're on. Have you ever talked to somebody that you didn't really know in real life? Have you ever been contacted? And you start those conversations, you open those lines of communication, they're likely to tell you, I got friend noticed from somebody, or I got contacted by this person, and it happens. Once you start those lines of communication, then you can move into the harder topics of, have you ever been asked for photos? Has anybody ever sent you a photo? Most kids nowadays will indicate that they have received an unwanted sexual photo, or they've been asked for one. And that's when you start those conversations of, you know, not to do this. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children on their website has some really good resources on how to start those conversations, how to talk to kids. They also have some various resources through their website on NetSmarts that are video games, videos, things like that, that are all age appropriate to help kids become more educated. So if you want your kids to be online, start them off with those safety topics, start them off with those situations where they can learn how to be safe. That way you can feel more assured. And then at the end of the day, it's just like anything else. You want to follow up with that. You want to check your kids' devices. You want to see what they're doing. You wouldn't hand a kid a loaded gun and say, here you go, and not teach them to be safe with it. A cell phone, a tablet is just as dangerous, if not more so, than a loaded gun, because you're not telling them how to be safe on that before you're just giving that device over. And so parents really need to have those conversations. They need to have those communications and be able to make sure that their kids feel comfortable with those open lines of communications, because time and again, when I dealt with these victims, the first thing that I heard was, I did something stupid. I was afraid of getting in trouble with my parent. I was embarrassed of what happened. And so it went on a lot longer than it should have. And it got worse than it needed to before it finally got disclosed.
We're going to throw links up to all these websites that he's talking about in the show notes, along with the QR code to get to his website. I want to move into a space. It's a little bit more about you, Randall. And I want to ask, you know, because we talked about this with Tony Rodarte. When you're a first responder, when you're a detective, when you're doing the line of work that you do, you see a lot of shit that, like, most people aren't supposed to see. And you're exposed to things that are really unnatural and abnormal. And that, there's no way around it, man. That has to impact your brain in some way. So let's dive into that space a little bit. As somebody who saw this year after year after year, what do you think that did to you mentally? And what do you think it's doing to other first responders who have to experience the same things?
At the high point of the law enforcement career that I had and doing internet crimes, we were averaging 3 search warrants a week. That meant that we were going out and we were seizing computers and we were having to go through devices, and we were looking at tens of thousands of images of children being sexually abused and exploited every day. And when I say children, yes, there are teenagers that are being involved in this. Yes, there are older kids, but we're also talking about infants. We're talking about toddlers. We're talking about newborns being sexually abused and exploited. And I can tell you that as a father, I was raising 3 kids while I was going to work and spending 10, 12, 14 hours a day looking at these horrific things. It messed me up. I would have flashbacks. I would have days where I would have to come home and tell my wife, I can't spend any time with the girls today, because I was looking at pictures of little blonde-haired, blue-eyed girls being sexually abused all day, and I don't want those to interfere with what I'm dealing with my kids. At the high point of its impact on me and the PTS that I was dealing with, I didn't know I was dealing with it at the time, but eventually learned that that's what it was. It was like one of those picture carousels, you know, the slides that we used to watch. We're old enough to know what the slide carousels were. Kids don't. But every time I would blink, a new picture would pop into my head of some abuse that I had seen, of some image that I had dealt with, of some video that I had had to watch and listen to and hear and see that kid get abused. And it was nonstop. And it got to a point where to try and go to sleep, I couldn't close my eyes to go to sleep because it was a constant replay of all of those photos and images and videos and conversations and things. And I started trying to find ways to get that out of my head. And unfortunately, the attitude in law enforcement is you cowboy up, you suck it up. You got to be able to do this. Otherwise, they're going to call you crazy. They're going to pull your badge and gun. You won't be able to do your job. You won't be able to support your family. And so the way that I dealt with it, and I knew it was wrong, but this is the way most of us deal with it, is I found a bottle of Jack and I used that to cope. And it got to the point where I was having to drink myself to sleep each night because otherwise I couldn't close my eyes. But that's what I had to do to be able to go to work the next day, because I knew if I didn't go to work the next day, some kid wasn't going to get rescued. Some kid was going to continue being abused. Some bad guy was going to be out there to do what he was doing.
Gosh, man. I mean, you said a couple of things there that just break my heart. And first up, I want to say to anybody who's choosing alcohol to, you know, numb the pain, it's really critical. And I say this on almost every podcast, Randall, that, you know, my psychiatrist friend, Dr. Dave, reminds me all the time that alcohol turns off the part of the brain that cares. And so if you're using alcohol, you're going to find that you start to care less about important things in your life. And so I just wanted to mention that. The second thing that you said that really broke my heart, man, was that you would go to work and you would experience things that wouldn't even, like, you couldn't even get into a headspace to be with your own children. And I don't know that that's something most of us consider, is that, you know, there's these first responders are out there and they're dealing with things that are so traumatic that they sort of make them pull back from their own families. And, you know, like your girls, they don't even get their daddy because of the shit you have to look at, of the things you have to see. And in those moments, how do you reconcile that? Like, I know you tell your wife, hey, I can't be around the girls right now, but then be honest with me, man, that's got to destroy you as you go and be by yourself and start drinking Jack.
I missed so much time with my family because of what was going on in my head that, and that's time that I can't ever make back. And I'm still having issues with trying to rebuild those relationships. My son at the time, I was his scout leader. He was working on his scouting. We would go on campouts. We would do all of the activities, but I wasn't really there because even though I was on that campout or we were doing that hike or whatever, my brain's going, okay, I don't know who this guy is. Maybe he's a creep. What's going to happen over here? What do I have to do at work when I get back on Monday? And part of the depression that comes with the lack of sleep, the dealing with all of these images, things like that, that was occurring, manifest in me with anger. I was angry at the world. I was angry at the suspects. I was angry at the way things were going and the situations that I was being put into. And unfortunately, a lot of that came out on my son and yelling at him, not being present when I needed to be. But then when I was present, I was pissed off at everything. And it all kind of came out on him. And just missing time with my girls, not being able to, you know, go and cuddle with them, go, you know, read them stories at bedtime and stuff, because I was so wrapped up with what was in my head that it was hard to cope. I had one case one time that was literally in the house directly behind mine, the block behind mine. And I was dealing with this little girl who was not much older than my girls. She was about the same age as my son. And I'm having to deal with the fact that she's been extorted for images. She's had all of this sexual abuse and sexual exploitation going on online. And she's, I can see her house from my backyard. She's, we share a wall, you know, and that really impacted the way that I would act when I was at home and how I could interact with my kids and the paranoia that came with, you know, them being online and wanting to be able to have that social interaction that is normalized now in kids with, you know, having a cell phone and being able to text and being able to go onto social media. And I locked stuff down for a very long time, more so than I probably should have.
We're going to talk about tools and kind of what you did to climb out of that here shortly. But one of the things that I'm sitting here wondering is it harder to be the kid of a cop? Is it harder to be the kid of a first responder?
My kids would probably say so. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like to think that it gave them a lot of good tools and that they're more aware of the world than a lot of kids. And as a result, they're less likely to become a victim or go through a lot of those experiences. But if you ask my older daughter, who's of the age that she's starting to date, she hates having a cop for a dad because every time she talks about a boy, I'm you know, figuring out how to run a background check on him. And
there you go.
Showing up at home with my gun and badge just to make sure he's aware.
There it is. You know, you said something about anger back then, and for most men that I've come in contact with, that's our common thread. We tend to reach for anger. And somebody a few years ago made a statement that changed my life, and they said, it was a woman, we were talking about something, and she said, you know, my anxiety shows up as anger. And that was like a light bulb moment for me. I said, oh my God. That's exactly what it is for me. Like, I'm anxious all the time. I'm concerned. I'm worried. The PTS, like, that you talk about, that presents as anger. And how do we overcome that hurdle, in your opinion?
You know, and I think the reason for that is it's more acceptable to be angry in public and have a scowl or, you know, be pissed off than it is to be emotional. And if we would learn to take that anxiety, to take that depression and express it in a helpful way, in a better way, crying or, you know, releasing that tension in some way that's positive or that's beneficial, I think we'd all be a lot healthier. But it's easier to be angry because then you can keep going through with your day-to-day activities. And I, you know, really the only way that I've found to address it so far is when I feel myself starting to get angry, or when my wife sees me starting to get angry, it takes that conscious reminder of, I'm not angry at the person I'm talking to. I'm not angry at what I'm seeing in front of me. I'm angry at something else, and I need to take a minute, take a breath, separate the two situations so that the emotion from this bad situation isn't bleeding out into the interaction that I'm having right now. And my wife is, she's been a godsend to really not only stand by me through the time that I've been, you know, an asshole for the last 20 years, but to also be there and say, you're getting angry. You're not angry at the kids. You're not angry at this situation. You're angry at something else. Take a breath. And you really have to make a conscious effort to separate out what you're doing and what you're feeling, and recognize why you're feeling it, so that you're expressing the emotions that are appropriate for the interaction that you're having.
Yeah, that's pretty critical and easier said than done, right? Because you know, in like a moment of rage or in a moment of anger, when somebody tells you to calm down, it's almost the last thing that you want to hear.
It doesn't work.
It doesn't work. It doesn't work at all. But if you have a good partner, if you have somebody you trust who you can kind of look at and they can look at you and really see you. But that's on you though, isn't it, Randall? Like, for, it's one thing for her to articulate it. It's another for you to take it to heart and actually act on it. So how long did it take? What was the adjustment period there where you were like, okay, I hear you. I trust you. I'm listening to you.
When I get there, I'll let you know.
Okay.
it's still a work in progress. It's still something that, you know, there are those times where she can give me that look and I recognize it, or she can say something and I can recognize it. There are other times where the switch moves before I can do anything or before she can do anything. And I have to come back and apologize later and own what I did and the fact that I'm owning it now when I wasn't before has been helpful in letting me recognize it next time a little bit faster. And fortunately, she's willing to put up with me while I'm still making those adjustments and still trying to get a handle on everything.
One of the things I'd love to talk about for a few minutes is this idea surrounding veterans, first responders, anybody who's got a job where, let's be honest, your feelings do not matter in the moment. When you're in the moment trying to solve a case, how you feel is irrelevant. And, you know, it's like check your crap at the door. Like you said earlier, cowboy up, man up, forget your stuff. We're in this space right now. And I understand that. And I understand that that's part of the job of working as a first responder, a veteran, some of the folks that are military members, you know. But how do we get to a point where we can balance that a little bit, where we recognize that, like, you could still be an amazing investigator, detective, military member, and you could have some stuff in your head that you haven't reconciled yet, and you might just need a few weeks off to process it, work through it, figure it out. Is there anything that you've discovered along the way that would lead us to close that gap a little bit more?
Well, I've been fortunate that my current administration is very proactive in being able to recognize that, and they've implemented a couple of different things to be able to help that. We have a peer support team, so anytime we have a scene where we think, man, this is really tough, we have the ability to go to one of those peer support members and say, look, I need to talk about this. If it goes beyond needing to just kind of talk it out and get it out of your head, there are options for other types of treatment, whether it be through a trained counselor, whether it be through an EMDR service, whether it be through something like that, where we can help do that. And they're recognizing that there are a lot of resources out there. A lot of the stigma of being damaged on the job mentally has started to go away as we've recognized that, after any time doing this job, you're going to have situations that need to be addressed. The biggest thing is just for the supervisors, especially first line supervisors, the sergeants, the lieutenants. When you know there's been a critical incident, when there's been any sort of a case involving a kid, if there's been a case involving a traumatic situation, talk to your guys. Give them a minute before they got to go to the next call and say, do we need to talk about this? Are you good? Do you need to unload anything? You know, sometimes there's calls stacked and you got to wait until an hour later, 2 hours later. But going back and following up and saying, what do we need to do? What do you need? What can I do to help you? Really goes a long way. And having that recognition and just having that ability to know that if this situation messed you up, it probably messed somebody else up too. And you don't need to feel alone. You don't need to feel isolated in those feelings, because we're all going through something. Even if it wasn't that particular scene, it may have been a different scene for somebody else. We're all going to go through that trauma, and we can feel comfortable in discussing it and getting it out there. And kind of once you unload it and get it off your shoulders, it makes it a lot easier to deal with in a lot of circumstances.
Yeah, Tony and I talked about this a little bit too, but by and large, people that are cops, people that are in the military, these are not lovey-dovey people. These are not folks who really want to sing the Kumbaya song and talk about their feelings all day. So I'm going to ask you, as a man and as a first responder, how did you flip the script and go, okay, talking about my feelings doesn't make me a wuss. It doesn't make me weak. It actually is the thing that makes me stronger than all of these other people that are here and won't talk about it. How did you flip that switch for you?
When I recognized how broken I was, I made sure to put that out there to the guys that were doing the same kind of stuff and say, look, man, I've been there. I get it. I'm broken too. And I'm here if you need help. And as I was training up my replacement, as I was preparing to retire, one of the things that I made sure to talk to him about all the time was, look, man, you're going to come across some really nasty stuff and it's going to impact you. So embrace that, be prepared for that, and address it as it comes instead of letting it build up and build up and finally boil over. And now you're too screwed up to work anymore, or you're doing something stupid, you're going out and you're drinking too heavy, whatever the case. I have no problem, once I recognized how broken I was, in going and expressing that to the other guys and saying, look, I'm broken. If you're broken too, let's work on this together. Let's fix each other. Let's help each other out. We came across a video one time that my Padawan was doing as part of his taking over my role, and it was horrible. I thought I had seen everything and seen the worst of it. My computer forensic examiner thought he had seen everything and been through the worst of it. And we looked at that, and all three of us walked away from the computer and went, whoop, we're done for the day. It's time to play Candy Crush for the rest of the shift, because we need to unload this before we take it home. And I think talking about that and starting those conversations and being vulnerable to your peers, being vulnerable to the people you work with, and letting them know that, look, we're all going to go through this. Let's go through it together. It's easier to deal with as a group, as a team, than it is to do it individually, made it a lot easier to for him to be able to open that up and for others to open that up. And now I'm just out there preaching that, you know, we're all going to go through bad stuff, and it's a lot easier to deal with together than it is trying to deal with by ourselves.
Dr. Dave on my podcast has said a number of times that it's not your job to give somebody else PTSD, meaning that it's not your job to share all the details of the horrific things that you've seen, because it's not fair to somebody. And even Tony alluded to this when we talked to him. He's like, I'm not going to tell you everything that I saw, because I don't want to put this shit in your head. Right. I don't want you to have these thoughts in your brain. And so, okay, I get that and I agree with that, but then your circle of people that you can talk to shrinks exponentially. And now the only people that you can talk to are maybe the one or two other people that have actually seen the same thing. Don't you think that makes it harder?
You know, I still think that there are some shared commonalities in the field. Do I want to go and talk about these traumas with, you know, a civilian that doesn't work the job? No, because they're not going to have those same shared experiences. But even the guys in my office that haven't worked child crimes or haven't worked internet crimes or haven't seen the images have traumas. And we can talk about it in generalities enough that we can get those things off of our chest. We can open up and be able to lift that weight off of each other's shoulders without having to know all the specifics. Tony did homicide for years and years and years. I can't even imagine the crap that he saw, because I don't like dead bodies. They stink. I don't want to be around them.
Right.
So he and I can't talk specifically about the traumas as it pertains to his homicides and my child crimes, because we don't have that shared. But can we still talk about, man, the job sucked. Man, it sucked going to those kinds of calls. Man, it sucked having to deal with those things and speak about it in enough generality that we can still help support each other in our situations and get some of that off our chest and know that we're not alone in the traumas. And I think that's the most important part, is supporting each other and taking away that feeling of isolation. Because when I was working in internet crimes, I would walk into the room every day and there's the rest of my team and everybody's doing their job and look to be happy and hunky-dory. And part of what weighed on me so much was I knew that what I was doing was affecting me, but it didn't look like it was affecting anybody else. And so I started questioning in my mind, am I screwed up? Is there something wrong with me that it's affecting me and nobody else looks like it? Or is everybody else putting on the same brave face that I am? Because I'm not telling everybody I'm screwed up. I'm not showing it. I'm doing my job. And that feeling of isolation, that feeling of being lonely in my trauma, I think is what made it worse at the beginning. And once I got over that, once I got over that feeling of I'm alone, I'm screwed up, and I started realizing, you know what, we're all screwed up in our own ways, so let's get it out there. And even if it's not specifics, we can all be screwed up together, is when a lot of that weight started lifting and it was a lot easier to deal with. And that's when I really started being able to focus on some of my healing.
Man, that's just, it's great information. And I think anybody who's ever felt that bit of isolation feels the exact same way. It's like you look around the people around you and you're thinking, are you not feeling this? Are you not seeing this? Like, am I the only one that knows how jacked up things are right now? And that's the danger of everybody putting on the brave face, is that you literally, like, for people like you and me, we sit there and we go, what's wrong with me? And it makes it worse. And boy, I love what you're talking about. You mentioned a couple of things so far that are so important. I think peer support groups, I think that's where it's at. For people like you and your industry, military members, veterans, really anybody, that peer support is the key. You know, we've had a couple of different doctors on the podcast, but one of them, Dr. Berselli, said, most of us don't need a therapist. Most of us don't need medication. We just need somebody to talk to and get this stuff off of our chest so that we can feel better about it. Do you remember, Randall, the first time that you ever kind of came forth and said, I'm not good. I am not okay. And I need help. Who was that to? And what happened next?
You know, honestly, there wasn't a time where I was able to be that honest with myself until my wife called me one day and said, that's it. Go get help or we're done. Because she was recognizing in me what I didn't want to recognize in myself. And once I had that gut punch moment, that's when I went, okay, yeah, I'm screwed up. You know, I'm causing damage to my wife. I'm causing damage to my family. Now it's time to fix it. And I drove straight to the doctor that day and went in and said, okay, I'm messed up. Help me. What do I do? Unfortunately, the first recommendation was, here's some pills. These will make you feel happier. And they did. I mean, I'm not going to lie. They helped, but it was contingent upon, and now you're going to go find somebody to talk to. Now you're going to go find something else. And, you know, really, if my wife hadn't done that, I don't know that I would have recognized it as early on. I think it would have gotten a lot worse before it could get better. And, you know, it took her just laying it out there for me to kind of open my eyes to what it was. Because up until that point, it was, I'm going to muscle through. I'm going to do this. I'm tough. I can handle this. You know, I'm fine. Everything's fine. And it wasn't.
And I can imagine that your ego took a big smash. Your pride took a big smash. So let's talk about that a little bit, man, because that's a really important part of coming out of this, is like that moment. So the moments we were talking about earlier, where you get angry and somebody else has to call you out on it, and you need to set your damn ego aside and go, you're right. Okay. It's showing up again. So how are you and I know you said you're working on it, but talk to me about some time where you've been approached, you've been called out on your stuff and you've accepted it.
You know, it happens regularly. Last week, we had family coming in town for an event, and I was stressed because I felt like I had a million things to do. You know, it was one of those situations where I had, you know, an hour's worth of stuff to do and a 20 minutes to do it in. And I snapped at her because I wasn't feeling supported. And it's not that she wasn't supporting me. It was just that I was so wrapped up in what was going on in my head that I wasn't seeing all the stuff that she was doing. And she gave it back to me, man. She handed it right back at me. You know, after she did that, I went, oh shit. Yeah. Okay. My bad. I'm sorry. I apologize. I'm stressed. I took it out on you. I shouldn't have. And it has taken a lot to, help me realize that, the people in my life and the situations in my life are so much more important than my pride, that I really have to set my pride aside a lot of the times and recognize, humble myself to recognize that I'm not perfect. I'm not going to be perfect, but I'm never going to get closer to perfection if I'm not willing to work on it and to build and to grow. And the only way I can do that is to recognize when I've made that mistake and then find a way to fix it. And, you know, I've been fortunate that she's been there as I need it to pop me upside the back of the head and go, okay, knock it off, jackass. And, yeah. And then, you know, move forward from there.
So you mentioned like medication, you mentioned going to see psychiatrists and getting on some pills. What other types of things have you treated yourself to help with PTS and, you know, just the anger and the drinking? Because I'm assuming you're not an alcoholic still.
No.
I'm assuming that maybe you've gotten a hold on that. So talk to me a little bit about the things and tools that you've tried.
Probably one of the best tools that I can throw out there for anybody dealing with any kind of trauma is EMDR. And that's, it's a program, and there's a couple of different versions of it out there. But essentially what it comes down to is when you're in a REM sleep, your brain is filing traumas and filing memories and filing things into your brain in the order that they're supposed to be in and put them in the places that they're supposed to be in. But what we find so many times with trauma is that it impacts our ability to get good sleep. It impacts our ability to go into that REM sleep. And so the brain isn't able to process things the way that they're supposed to. EMDR is an eye movement therapy that is used to simulate that REM sleep so that your brain gets back to processing things where it's supposed to be and putting those things away and helping you unpack those traumas so that they're not forefront on your brain, they're put away where they need to be. And through EMDR and a couple of other types of biofeedback therapies that do similar things in stimulating the brain to file those memories where they need to be instead of keeping them right there at where they're impacting you and they're coming up all the time. It really helps you to put all of that where it needs to be so that you can move forward. After that, I've been in a talk therapy for about 2 years now, where I've been able to kind of work through some of the thoughts, some of the traumas, be able to put them into perspective, get some ideas on ways to cope with things better. And as part of that, I was told that I should journal. I should be able to take those thoughts as they come, put them out on paper, and really focus on getting it all out, putting out how it feels and everything else. I'll admit, I didn't do well at journaling. I saved it all up, but when I decided to do it, I did it all at once, and that's where my book came from, was you know, me taking all of those experiences and really pouring them out so that I could get them out of my head, get them out of my thought processes, and be able to say, okay, here's how screwed up I am, here's why I'm screwed up. You guys go learn something from this if you want to read the book and find out what's really out there. And it helped get it out of my head in a way that I hope can be helpful to somebody else to avoid their kids becoming a victim and having to deal with that. And hopefully, you know, if any investigators are reading it, they can go through it and learn from my mistakes and be able to say, yeah, I recognize that. I've seen that. I've done that. Here's how I'm going to not follow in his footsteps and, you know, drink Jack Daniels until 2 a.m. to try and cope with it.
Man, the world needs a lot of superheroes, and I hope that over this last few years, as you've been working on yourself, that you understand the value you bring to our world. There are people who try to make the world a better place, and there's people who try to make it worse. And you are clearly in category A, as somebody who's trying to make the world a better place, trying to keep our children safe, trying to help people understand that the trauma they experience can be worked through, whether it's EMDR or talk therapy or journaling or finding a medication that speaks to you. What you're doing to make the world a better place is commendable. It's admirable. It's not something everybody wants to take on. And so talk to me a little bit about how you feel when I say that about you.
I don't feel, I don't feel like a superhero. I feel like a guy who just wanted to go out. I wanted to be a cop all my life. I knew I wanted to do something in this field. I never imagined it would lead to me pretending to be a 14-year-old girl online for 6 years, but right. You know, I'm seeing the things that I did, but I knew I wanted to help. And I think that every person can help the world in their way, even in little ways. And so what, I like that I was able to make impacts in kids' lives. I like that I was able to get some really nasty guys off the street so they can't hurt kids anymore. But everybody has the ability to do something to make the world a little bit better place. And if everybody does, think of how much better it could be. You know, people always said when I was working the job, man, how can you do that? Grizzled homicide guys that had seen everything. Man, how can you look at those pictures? How can you do that job? Because every one of those SOBs I put away was one less that I had to worry about going after my kids. And it maybe sounds a little selfish, but at the end of the day, every one of them that doesn't go after my kids probably isn't going after your kids either. And so if everybody did that one little thing to kind of help each other out, I think we'd all be a lot better off and our kids would be safer. Our grandkids would be safer. You know, the next generation could be better than we are.
Man, that's a great place to wrap up. The book is called Cyber Creeps. There's a QR code in the show notes of our podcast to link to Randall's website if you want to learn more. Pardon me. And I really hope that folks have taken a lot from this podcast, especially first responders. And isn't it so important to say to them, like, the job is hard. There's going to be really difficult things about it, but it's one of these things where what I talk to a lot of people about now is like, yeah, you should want to take care of other people. You should want to make the world a better place, but not at the expense of yourself. Like, you don't have to die inside saving the world. There's a way to do this where you can feel good about yourself and you can feel good about the work you're doing, right?
Right, absolutely. And, you know, here's the thing that I've had to learn myself, and I hope that the new guys coming out and the officers and first responders that are still out there can learn is, you know, you may want to go out there and save the world, but you can't do it if you haven't taken care of yourself. You know, it's just like when you're on the airplane, you have to put your own mask on before you can help anybody else, because if your mask isn't on, you can't help anybody. If you're not taking care of yourself, if you're not helping yourself to stay healthy, you're not going to be healthy enough to do anything for anybody else. And so, you know, we've got to be taking care of ourselves. Police suicides, we lose 3 times more officers every year to suicides than we do to felonious gunfire and outside influences. And that's just that we can't keep that up. The statistics coming out of the military of the military suicides because of unrecognized PTS is too much. We have to take care of ourselves if we want to take care of anybody else. And that starts with recognizing when we have a problem, being willing to open up and talk about what has upset us, and taking those steps necessary to move through it. And if you can't do that, you can't help anybody else.
We have 3 goals with Learn from People Who Lived It. 1, to help you feel less alone. 2, encourage you to seek out a coach, a therapist, a church, anyone who can help you get through your journey and find some healing. 3, when you're ready, share your story with us.
Find Learn from People Who Lived It wherever you get podcast. Search it using all one word, Learn from People Who Lived It.
Here's a question for you. Are you a transitional character in your lineage? It's one of my favorite things to ask people these days as a motivational speaker, and I would love an opportunity to come into your business, your nonprofit, your corporation, your church, your schools, and if you've got a group of people that could really benefit from the value of a self-care strategy so they show up better for you, let's do this thing. Rates depend on the size of your group, and we can connect at learnfrompeoplewholivedit.com. My 75-minute workshop is engaging, it's interactive, it's real, it's authentic, and most importantly, as I said a moment ago, your folks will leave with a self-care strategy that will have them showing up as the best versions of themselves for you. Learn from people who lived it.com. Click on the speaking tab.